content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Kiplinger's Magazine, the AARP Bulletin, and Money.com. Our first article today is from the July 2022 issue of Kiplinger Magazine, and it's by Nellie S. Huang, How to Decipher Mutual Fund Returns, a guide to the many ways these popular investments measure their performance. Past performance may be little guarantee of future results, but when we assess investments, especially mutual funds, past performance is an informative measure. But it's not the only one. The trick is to understand what you're looking at when you scrutinize performance. And it's come to our attention that some investors are misreading key facets of mutual fund returns. To set the record straight, we've put together a primer based on questions we've received from readers about fund returns. Knowledge is power, after all, and a better understanding will help you make smarter investment decisions. All returns and data are through May 6th. What's a total return? A fund's total return, as it appears in Kiplinger's fund tables, on the fund's website, or in its prospectus, is the rate of return over a specified period. According to rules set by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the return is adjusted for any fees or expenses charged to investors, including annual fees and sales charges, also known as loads, on shares purchased. So, no matter how high the fees, they've already been accounted for in the returns. That's why it's important to make sure you're eyeing the right share class of any given fund before you start digging into its returns. Some fund companies have multiple classes, say Class A or C or I. Each one may charge a different expense ratio and sales load, and that impacts returns. A lot of people don't understand that different share classes of the same fund will have different returns because the fees can vary widely, says Lauren Gedkowski Lindsay, a certified financial planner in Hyannis, Massachusetts. The total return also assumes reinvestments of all dividends and capital gains distributions, as well as any sales charges associated with reinvesting those payouts. The calculation is designed to help investors compare the performance of funds, even if they have different expense ratios or loads. Just make sure the dates of the returns you're scrutinizing match up, especially if you're comparing returns from different sources. Timing matters. Why doesn't my personal return match the fund's reported returns? Make sure you're looking at the return for the share class you hold. Then, bear in mind that the returns you see listed in the fund's prospectus or website, or on fund tracker sites such as Morningstar.com, assume a lump sum investment on the first day of the reporting period. If your investment period starts on a different date, or if you're dollar cost averaging, that's investing fixed sums at regular intervals, your return will be different. Remember, too, that fund performance numbers assume all dividend, interest, and capital gains distributions were reinvested. If you took a cash payout instead of reinvesting it in any instance, that would also affect your performance. Are the fund's annualized returns the same as an average of annual returns over that period? Yes, roughly speaking, but not exactly. When it comes to periods of longer than 1 year, typically you'll see annualized returns. These are basically the average annual returns earned over the period. The actual math behind annualized returns, called a geometric mean, is more complicated than a simple arithmetic average, but essentially a 3-year annualized return reflects what you've earned in the fund in each of the past 3 years. Annualized returns differ from cumulative returns, which are aggregate returns of an investment over time. They're often not reported. We only occasionally cite them in our stories in Kiplinger. The cumulative 5-year return of the Vanguard 500 Index Fund, for instance, is 87.8%, but its annualized 5-year return is 13.4%. The cumulative return doesn't average to 13.4% because annualized returns capture the effects of compounding by taking into account the change in the value of your investment. You can always bank on funds with great long-term returns, right? Not necessarily. Annualized returns can be skewed by a great year or two and mask a mediocre or downright disastrous year in between, and vice versa. You might think, for instance, that a fund with a great 10-year record is a great investment. Center American Select Equity Fund, for instance, which invests in large company stocks, has a market-beating 10-year annualized return of 14.1%. But on closer examination, it has lagged the S&P 500 index in 6 of the past 10 calendar years. In short, it's always a good idea to dig into a fund's calendar year returns too. Beating its benchmark or similar funds in 8 of the past 10 years, say, might be a better measure of success than an annualized return skewed by 1 or 2 outlier years. Can cost basis be used to measure performance? No. Eyeballing your cost basis, the amount you've shelled out for a particular investment, and comparing it with the fund's current value may seem a quick, easy way to gauge performance. But it's best used for tax filing purposes to calculate capital gains and losses, not for gauging cumulative returns. When a fund pays a distribution in the form of a dividend or capital gain, it becomes part of the overall return you've earned in the investment. If those distributions are reinvested in the fund, however, they are added to your cost basis because the payout is used to buy more shares. Consider this example. You invest $10,000 each in 2 funds called Fund A and Fund B. After 1 year, the underlying assets in Fund A have increased $1,000 in value. But because no distributions have been made, your cost basis in the fund remains $10,000. Fund B, on the other hand, has not increased in value, but it has distributed $1,000 in dividends, which were reinvested, pushing your cost basis up to $11,000. The 1-year performance of both funds is the same, a 10% return, but it might not seem that way to someone looking at the different cost bases of the 2 funds. Shouldn't I focus on after-tax returns, because that's what I'm actually pocketing in the end? After-tax returns appear in fund prospectuses. You can ignore them if you hold the fund in a tax-advantaged account, because earnings are tax-deferred anyway. If you own the fund in a taxable account, these returns offer a glimpse at how much of the return is left after taxes are taken out. But be careful about generalizations. The calculation uses the highest individual federal tax rate and doesn't include state or local taxes, so it may not even match your situation. How does a fund's 30-day yield measure performance? It doesn't really. A fund's yield is a measure of how much income you might receive from the fund over the course of a year. But like other distributions, the payouts become part of the fund's total return. The 30-day yield will matter most to bond fund investors. If you have $50,000 to invest, then a fund with a 30-day yield of 2% could provide $1,000 a year in income. The way this particular yield is calculated is designed to allow investors to reliably compare one fund's 30-day yield to another's. Just make sure you compare yields of the same date, especially now with interest rates on the rise. The bond index, Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond, sported a 30-day yield of 2.32% in early March, but by early May, it had a yield of 3.61%. Our second article is from the AARP Bulletin of June 2022, the Financially Speaking column by Linda Stern. Is it time to sell your house? Cashing out in a hot market isn't always a good idea. Some people I know are playing a new game of sorts, going on real estate websites every few weeks to see how much the estimated value of their house has risen. Home prices have surged for 2 years now. The average increase over that time is above 30%, and the gains kept coming this spring. Those of us who have owned our homes for years can probably find a buyer easily and net a lot of cash for our retirement. So, should we take the money and run? If the market craters later on, maybe we'll be sorry we didn't sell now. But then, where to live next? That is the crux of the dialogue playing out now at our kitchen tables. People are looking at prices as the reason to sell. But they have questions about where they are going to go, says Linda Chaletsky, an agent who works in the Washington, D.C. metro area. There is not a lot of choice out there. There are good reasons to sell right now, but it may still be the wrong time to make the right move. Let's break it down. Catching the top? The one thing that you should absolutely not do is to try to time the market, says Rachel Elson, a financial advisor with Paragon Wealth Management in San Francisco, where the market is hot, hot, hot. If you sell thinking that you are going to hit the market top and rent until house prices fall, you might end up renting for life because home prices continued to rise while you were out of the market. That's what happened to an acquaintance of Elson's who sold his home a few years ago. He's still renting. Nobody really knows, or should try to predict, where the housing market is headed. Higher mortgage rates, which were rising sharply in March and April, could dampen housing prices, or have little effect. One thing not to plan on is a relapse of the sickness that sent home prices down 21% between 2006 and 2011. Before that crash, the housing market had been propped up by mortgage lenders offering zero documentation, zero down payment mortgages to anyone and everyone. The situation is very different now, says Joel Kahn, Associate Vice President of Economic and Industry Forecasting for the Mortgage Bankers Association. Households have a lot of savings. The bulk of home buyers are putting down decent down payments. There's no big subprime market like we saw in the early 2000s, and mortgage delinquencies are down sharply. All of that makes a housing debacle far less likely than it was in 2006. After the sale. Another crucial part of deciding whether to sell, figuring out where you are going to go next. If you still love living in your home, don't want to give up your neighbors, and haven't thought through your next stage, stay put. While your house has risen in value, so have all the other homes in your neighborhood. By the time you sell your home, move to a smaller one, and fix it up a little, you may be disappointed at how little money you actually walk away with, Elson says. But if you have already been mulling a move to a cheaper region, to be nearer your kids, to life with fewer staircases, now could be a great time to sell and buy so the market doesn't slip away from you. Now is also a good time to sell if you don't have much savings and need the equity from your home to fund your retirement, Elson says. You can do away with property taxes and maintenance and extract the equity and invest it and live on it, she says. But, she adds, you have to get comfortable with renting. Not sure what to do? It's never too early to start exploring the market to see what else is out there for you. And, Chaletsky suggests, you might start on the clean-out and home improvements that will make selling your home easier once you're ready. It's always the right time for that. Our fourth article today is another from the June 2022 issue of the AARP Bulletin, and this article is by Kimberly Lankford. Why to keep working after retirement? Here are 8 good reasons, only one having to do with money. Working in retirement might sound like a contradiction in terms, but that's not necessarily the case. Just because you have moved on from your primary career doesn't mean a part of your work can't or shouldn't go to some money-making endeavor. Part-time, freelance, or consulting work, or volunteering, can help add to your retirement satisfaction and round out your schedule. And then there are the financial benefits. Here are 8 specific reasons to consider re-entering the job market. Number 1, a cushion for your savings. Working longer is going to be a really powerful lever to increase the money available in retirement because you're not drawing down your savings, and it gives you more of an opportunity to save, says Anqi Chen of the Boston College Center for Retirement Research. Don't assume you have to pound the pavement searching for a high-paying job, because earning just a portion of your previous salary can make a difference financially. A 2020 paper from the center found that for people 62 and older, even jobs that don't offer health and retirement benefits can substantially improve retirement security. Number 2, exercise for your brain. The University of Michigan's Health and Retirement Study, HRS, which has been tracking participants over age 50 for decades, pretty strongly shows that continuing to work has benefits for cognition, says Amanda Sanega, associate research scientist at the University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research. This isn't just because people with better cognitive health are better able to work, she says. You can get a particular kind of benefit by switching to a different type of job or role. Learning new things, psychologists call it novelty processing, may help slow cognitive decline. 3. Overall health. The transition to partial employment or volunteer work unrelated to your prior career also appears to be associated with fewer physical declines and better mental health, Sanega says. A University of Maryland study of more than 12,000 retirees involved in the HRS research found that having a post-career job was associated with fewer major diseases and functional limitations. 4. A sense of community. The Harvard study of adult development has been tracking generations of families since 1938, and one of its major findings has been how much retirement well-being depends on having good quality relationships, says Robert J. Waldinger, professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the current director of the study. Participants who were happiest in retirement replaced their old work relationships with new relationships. Doing any regular work, whether full-time, part-time, or as a volunteer, creates an environment for new interactions that can develop into those new relationships. 5. A sense of purpose. A job is one motivator to get up in the morning, and one of the major findings of the HRS research was the importance of finding a new sense of purpose after retirement. That theme of meaning and purpose keeps popping up as a major driver of a healthy retirement, says Nathan Labrassieu, professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at the Mayo Clinic. And continuing to work in some capacity is a great way to achieve that. Research shows that people with a sense of purpose feel younger in retirement. Number 6, a chance to give back. One of the great blessings of retirement, says Tim Maurer, a financial planner in Charleston, South Carolina, is that it gives you the opportunity to help others as well as yourself. A great example could be someone who worked as a fashion designer, teaching a class at a local vocational technical high school or college, or a mechanical engineer working part-time at a home improvement store as one of the friendly people who can help me find what I'm looking for. One piece of evidence for the benefits of giving back? A 2021 study of retirees in England found that volunteer work in retirement was associated with less depression and higher satisfaction and quality of life. Improvements in volunteers' well-being disappeared once they stopped volunteering. 7. Good times. Whether you're spending time with people you like or working in an environment that coincides with your hobbies, say a plant nursery, a golf course, a job can be fun. When evaluating opportunities, ask, does this provide me with a community of people that I enjoy? Says Nancy Collamer, a retirement coach and author of Second Act Careers. Are there opportunities for growth, challenge, or learning? This can be an opportunity to find a job or freelance work that you always thought would be interesting, but you never tried because it paid less or had fewer employee benefits than your previous job. And number 8, serving the greater good. There were 11.5 million job openings in the U.S. at the end of March, the highest level since the government started measuring this in 2000. While the job market varies widely by region, stories of severe worker shortages are widespread. Why not help a local business that is struggling with too few workers get through this period? Given the market, you should have ample choices to find a role you would enjoy. Our third article today is from Money.com, published June 6, 2022, and its author is Adam Hardy. The year Social Security will run out of money just changed for the better. After years of alarming headlines about the imminent insolvency of Social Security, Americans just got some good news. The agency's funds are now predicted to run out of money in 2035, 1 year later than expected. The update came in the latest annual report from the group of trustees tasked with monitoring the financial status of federal safety net programs, Social Security, and Medicare. In the report, released Thursday, June 1st, the trustees projected that the government will be able to pay out full Social Security benefits for longer due to the way the U.S. economy has bounced back from the pandemic. The economic recovery has been stronger than assumed in last year's reports, with faster-than-expected increases in employment, earnings, and gross domestic product, GDP, the trustees wrote. Social Security benefits, which aid more than 65 million Americans through monthly payments, are broken down into two key components, retirement benefits and disability benefits. Retirement funds are expected to run dry by 2034, a one-year improvement since the last report. Disability benefits are doing much better. They are expected to fully pay out for the next 75 years at least. Combined, the Social Security coffers would last until 2035. The report also showed that hospital benefits through Medicare, aka Part A, are slated to pay up until 2028, 2 years later than previous estimates. The medical insurance portion of Medicare is financed indefinitely because its funding is pulled from premiums and other tax revenues. Social Security is not going away, but it might change. On the whole, the report was a marked improvement from last year's bleak projections. The trustees attributed much of the gains to a rapidly improving labor market. The idea is that when more people are working and seeing wage gains, it translates into more tax revenue to fund these vital programs. However, several of them are still on precarious financial footing. In the coming years, these programs face major challenges because more baby boomers will retire, drastically shifting the ratio of workers to beneficiaries. At the same time, lower birth rates mean there will be a smaller supply of workers, and thus less tax revenue to fund the programs. When the funds are depleted, benefits will be cut. Come 2034, the year retirement funds are expected to run dry, the Social Security Administration will only be able to pay out 77% of its benefits to retirees. Already, this is reshaping how retirement savers feel about their golden years. According to a recent survey from investment firm Principal, 64% of workers are concerned that Social Security benefits won't be available to them throughout retirement, and some 80% expect they'll need to continue working to make ends meet. Current retirees are also getting hammered by inflation. The Senior Citizens League, a nonprofit advocacy group, predicts that Social Security beneficiaries will receive an 8.6% cost of living adjustment in 2023. But even that won't offset the surging prices retirees face. Despite nominal increases each year, the buying power of Social Security checks has diminished 40% since 2000, TSCL found. Congress could act to address these funding shortfalls before the programs are insolvent. Still, experts say retirees likely can't and shouldn't rely solely on the prospect of receiving Social Security benefits. Instead, Americans should start saving as early as possible through employee-sponsored 401k plans and/or individual retirement accounts. Our fifth and final story is also from Kiplinger's July 2022 issue. Bag a credit card bonus. You can snag a slew of points by signing up for a new rewards card and spending big in the first few months. The Chase Sapphire Preferred, with an annual fee of $95, recently upped its sign-up bonus to 80,000 points for new cardholders who spend $4,000 in the first 3 months. And those points are worth $1,000 if you redeem them for travel booked through the Chase Ultimate Rewards portal. There are restrictions on who can access the bonus. For example, if you already received a sign-up bonus connected to any Chase Sapphire card in the past 48 months, you are excluded from this new offer. Go to www.chase.com for more information. The Capital One Venture X annual fee of $395 offers a bonus of 75,000 miles for those who spend $4,000 in the first 3 months. The points are worth $750 if you redeem them for travel purchases made through Capital One's travel portal. Plus, you can earn an extra 10,000-mile bonus, or $100 towards travel, every card anniversary. To see other cards with sign-up bonuses, go to www.thepointsguy.com. Score a statement credit. With some cards, you earn a statement credit when you use the card at a partner merchant. American Express, Bank of America, Capital One, and Chase all allow cardholders to earn statement credits on top of rewards points they accumulate if they use their cards at restaurants, stores, or travel providers, or to pay for subscriptions. Capital One Shopping, for example, recently offered a 6% statement credit for renting a car from Hertz. To access the offers, log in to your account and follow the instructions. Offers generally rotate, so it's best to check in periodically. Save at the pump. Gas prices have been stubbornly north of $4 a gallon, and Kiplinger forecasts even higher prices this summer. A gas rewards credit card can help. The Abound Credit Union Platinum Visa offers 5% cash back on fuel purchases paid at the pump. Sam's Club members should consider the Sam's Club MasterCard. It offers 5% back on up to $6,000 spent yearly at eligible gas stations. Membership starts at $45 a year. The American Express Blue Cash Preferred, annual fee of $95 waived the first year, offers 3% back on gas purchases. Your local grocery store may offer a fuel discount as well. Giant, for example, offers 10 cents off per gallon for every 100 points you accumulate through its fuel program with Shell. You earn 1 point per dollar spent, and you can redeem a maximum of 1,500 points per fill-up. Points expire 30 days after you earn them. We've run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.